Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 71, Genomics, Proteomics, Cellular Immunity, and Antimatter. This episode of Futures in Biotech is brought to you by Kaleidograph, a thoughtfully designed graphing and data analysis application for research scientists, as well as those in the business and engineering fields. Try Kaleidograph for 45 days, risk-free, and receive a 20% discount if you purchase Kaleidograph within the next 60 days. Visit www.synergy.com/podcast.htm for more details.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there the extension?
About 30-40% for humans, that would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy?
Ballpark, 10 years.
So potentially one of the things that will end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun is the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare it to our closest evolutionary relative.
Let's get this started. We have an amazing show today. We have a total of five professors, and we're going to talk big science. We're going to talk massive genomic projects. We're going to talk massive proteomics projects. We're going to talk, antimatter projects at CERN. And we're going to talk about some really interesting virology and immunology with Dr. Vincent Racaniello from This Week in Virology. So we're gonna cover a lot of material. We have five professors. And at the end of the show, send me an email and we'll send you your bachelor's degree in science. So I'll do a roundtable. Let's start off with Vincent Racaniello. He's our first panelist, and he's a professor of microbiology and host of This Week in Virology and This Week in Parasitism, both which were in the top 10 on iTunes for medicine this week, today.
Is that right?
And and you're a professor at Columbia University. Yeah, you're
congratulations,
really
Vincent.
That's awesome.
Cool, thank you. Hey, thanks for having me back, Mark, and hi, everybody else.
Yeah, we hope it rubs off on us a little bit. Okay, so next, we have Andre Nantel, who's a senior research officer at the Biotechnology Research Institute in Montreal. He runs the microarray lab there. And he's also an adjunct professor at McGill University. And he's been a host and a panelist and a guest on this show. Welcome to the show.
As always, Mark, I'm happy to be the purveyor of fine genetically engineered roadkill for the information superhighway.
Cool. As a very special guest, we've invited, because Andre is going to be talking about a fantastic paper. We thought that it'd be great if we pull in one of the authors of this paper. And so we brought in Dr. Mark Gerstein, who is the Albert L. Williams Professor of Biomedical Informatics. He's also a professor of molecular biophysics and biochemistry and a professor of computer science at Yale University. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Sure.
You were actually a guest on episode 34. So if anybody wants to hear more about Mark's work, you can tune into episode 34. And now he isn't here by video. So for those people that are watching, he will be tuning in with his audio. But we thought, what a great opportunity to bring him in to really get the precise, detailed information about one of the biggest projects out there. And it's an honor to have him on board. Last but not least, we have Dr. George Farr, who's a vice president of biochemistry and biophysics at Aromics LLC here in Cleveland. Welcome, George.
Hi, guys.
I'm also going to be doing a little camera switching over here, so it's going to be a little tricky.
That'll be entertaining, right?
Yeah, it's a little practice. There we go. Back. That works. Okay, so this is going to be a really crazy show. We're going to try and fit it all in. It might take a little extra time. And we're going to talk amazingly big projects. But to start off, before we get into the crazy big projects, we'll start talking about a paper entitled Antibodies Mediate Intracellular Immunity Through Tripartite Motif Containing 21. So that's pretty hardcore. Vincent, why'd you pick this paper?
I picked this because we don't really talk much about immunity. We talk about how viruses kill you. So I thought we would talk about why most of us are still living despite there being so many viruses everywhere. And that's because we have a great immune system. And this paper begins to address how a really important component of the immune system works, and that is antibodies. So I sent Burke one picture, two pictures. If we could put the first one up, it shows an antibody molecule, and that would be good to start. So as everyone knows, when you get infected with any kind of, no, that's hydrogen, I think. That's it's not an antibody. As everyone knows, when you get infected with a pathogen, your body makes a series of immune responses. It starts with what's called an innate immune response, where the pathogen's recognized. You make interferons. It's the other one. It's called antibody. And then you have, within a week or two, what's called an adaptive immune response. And a major component of that is called an antibody. And antibodies are very large proteins, which we're trying to get a picture of here in a moment. There you go. They're Y-shaped, and the one end of them, the part, the Y end, which is basically duplicated, is the part that recognizes the pathogen, in our case, the virus. And the other end is a conserved end, and that is going to be very important for what we're talking about today. So if you could put the next picture up, it shows how we think antibodies work. They basically protect you and help you recover from infection. So when you get a vaccine, for example, your body makes antibodies. And then if you ever encounter the pathogen, you're protected. So on the left is a scheme of how a virus might get into a cell. This happens to be a rhinovirus. And these viruses always bind to the cell surface. They're taken up into cells in a variety of ways. And rhinoviruses get in by what we call the endocytic pathway, which is a normal pathway by which particles are taken into cells. Now, antibodies interfere with that uptake in a variety of ways, and that is shown on the right in that picture. They can prevent the binding of the particles. They can prevent the release of the nucleic acid within the cell at a later step. But the way antibodies prevent virus infection, a process that we call neutralization, hasn't really ever been sorted out especially well. So that's where this paper comes in. And that's why I picked it, because it provides a really beautiful mechanism for how an antibody that protects you from infection probably works. And this story begins at a previous paper where the authors found that there's a protein in the cytoplasm of the cell, and this is called TRIM21. Okay, TRIM stands for tripartite motif containing protein, and it's number 21. There's a whole family of these proteins. So this protein's in the cytoplasm, and the neat thing about it was that it was found to bind antibodies with very, very high affinity. And they bind to the opposite part of the antibody from the Y, that conserved part that we showed in that original picture. So based on that observation, these authors said, we wonder if the fact that this protein can bind antibodies in the cytoplasm is of some consequence. Maybe it has something to do with preventing infection. So that's where this paper comes in. They did a series of experiments to try and figure out if TRIM21 has anything to do with the ability of an antibody to block virus infection. Okay? So the very first experiment they did, they did all the experiments in this paper with adenovirus. So this is a virus that causes in people common colds, eye infections, gastroenteritis, and they had antibodies to this virus. So they coat the virus with antibodies, and then they add them to cells. So the antibody virus complexes are taken up into the cell, and then they stain the cell for TRIM21 and virus. And what they found is that when the antibody-coated viruses get into the cell, they end up getting coated with TRIM21. So remember, TRIM21 is a protein that was previously found to bind antibodies with very, very high affinity. And they did this with a couple of different antibodies against adenovirus, and they all did the same thing. They entered cells with the particle, and then they bound TRIM21. So that suggests that something's going on with TRIM21 in the cell. So the next thing they did is ask, is that interaction important? is the interaction of TRIM21 with the antibody of any consequence? So they depleted TRIM21 from cells. They used interfering RNAs to do that. And when you lower the amount of TRIM21 in the cell, then the antibody has less effect at blocking viral infection. So the effect of these antibodies when you coat the virus with them is that they block the ability of the virus to infect cells. If you remove TRIM21, you take away that ability. So in other words, the ability of an antibody to block adenovirus infection depends on the presence of this protein, TRIM21, in the cell cytoplasm. And they also show that if you take these antibodies, now there's an interesting property of antibodies found many years ago. You can treat them with a enzyme and it will nicely cut the conserved domain away from the rest of the antibody that binds the virus. So if you cut the antibodies in that way, TRIM21 doesn't work. So the antibodies have to be intact. All right. Now, how does this work? So TRIM21 is obviously important in blocking infection along with antibodies. How does it work? So it turns out that TRIM21 is what we call a ubiquitin ligase. It is an enzyme that attaches a small protein called ubiquitin to a variety of proteins, and that targets the proteins to be degraded. So in other words, TRIM21 labels a protein in the cell saying, we don't want this anymore, let's get rid of it. So the idea here is that maybe by virtue of TRIM binding the antibody, it will then say, let's degrade the virus that's attached to the antibody, and that may be how the infectivity is destroyed. So it turns out they did a variety of experiments to look at that, and it turns out that TRIM21 probably in some way targets the virus to be degraded. It's very interesting. They didn't find direct ubiquitination of the virus, but it looks like TRIM21 itself is ubiquitinated by itself. So then that whole complex, the TRIM21, the antibody, and the virus all gets degraded. And it's degraded by a big structure in the cell called the proteasome, whose function is to do that.
Let me see if I get this right. So we have a protein called TRIM21 in our cells.
That's right.
It binds to antibodies that are bound to virus, and then it sucks them into this vortex called the proteasome.
That's right.
To kill it.
And it degrades it. And in fact, in the paper, they show that the viruses are degraded in a proteasome-dependent way, and that, of course, destroys their infectivity. And so this is how this particular set of antibodies, at least, can protect us from infection. It pulls the virus into the proteasome and it destroys it. In fact, you don't even need virus. If you just add antibodies to cells, they will bind TRIM21 and they'll be sucked into that vortex. Nice imagery there, Mark. Very good.
Well, I've seen the proteasome firsthand under a microscope. It's a pretty big complex.
They're huge, right? Yeah. Why is this important, right? Why is this so interesting? Okay. Well, it may turn out that maybe this is how most antibodies work. Maybe antibodies against most viruses work by sucking them into the proteasome. So it turns out that TRIM21 is actually a protein that is turned on in the very early stages of the immune response, of the innate immune response. So the innate immune response is what what most organisms have and which is on all the time. So you can imagine that when a virus infects you, first TRIM21 is turned on. And then when the antibodies kick in a week or two later, they combine with TRIM21 and you get this very effective neutralization. So it could be that a nice therapy to prevent infections may involve making TRIM21 at good levels. And maybe that doesn't happen all the time, and that's why sometimes we get infections. Sure, so it could have some practical properties, right?
Absolutely. So Vincent, does the antibody get ubiquitinated?
It doesn't look like the antibody gets ubiquitinated. It looks like TRIM21 is the only component in the complex that is ubiquitinated.
Interesting.
So by virtue of a real high affinity
with the antibody and then the antibody with the virus, it just really pulls everything in to the proteasome as the TRIM is initially being degraded. That's amazing. And so the TRIM21 protein, it'll bind to any antibody, right? I mean, it does pretty much doesn't matter. Any antibody is just going to bind to with high affinity.
Yeah, with IgGs is what they have looked at, and as long as it has an intact Fc domain, that conserved domain, it will bind TRIM21. That's right.
Okay. Do you think the affinity is strong enough to use a TRIM protein as a surrogate secondary antibody? There's a lot of situations that could be useful.
In fact, they say it's one of the highest affinity interactions they've ever seen in cells. So the answer is probably yes. You could probably do that. It's amazingly strong. Yeah. Now, one thing that I really like about this, when I was a student, we were taught this very interesting finding, which is that some viruses, it only takes one or a couple of antibodies to actually block infection. Okay, so for example, polio and adeno, only one antibody is enough to block infection. So one antibody per particle, that is. And for influenza virus, five or six antibodies. And we could never understand that. Like, how could one antibody block infection? But, of course, if it turns out that that antibody binds with high affinity to TRIM21, that's enough to pull it into the vortex, to Mark's vortex. So this explains that and a lot of other old observations that no one could ever explain.
Mark has a question.
Oh, yeah. So this is Mark. I was just curious, could you say a little bit more about what TRIM21, what it looks like, or, you know, I mean, a little bit more characterize it?
So TRIM is part of a family of proteins, all of which are involved in immunity. And they have a ring finger domain. They have one or two zinc fingers as well, and they have a coiled coil region. And some of them have ubiquitin ligase activity. Others, we don't know how they work, but they're involved in defense against, in particular, HIV-1, for example. Some of the TRIM members have been shown to be important in defense against those viruses. So they're involved in host defense. That seems to be their major role. The specific mechanisms haven't been worked out, and this is one of the first that we seem to be understanding pretty well.
Yeah, but I guess what I was getting at, which you were answering, was if it's part of a family, is there maybe like a TRIM22 or that sort of does something fairly similar, but maybe a variation on it?
Well, so a number of them are ubiquitin ligases. How they all work is not really known. Some of them, for example, target HIV virions for degradation, but how that does it isn't exactly worked out. I suspect that there are a variety of mechanisms involved within the entire protein family. The only thing that's in common is this conserved structure with, as I said, the ring finger, the zinc finger, and the coiled coil.
I'm going to interject here, and because I'm kind of like upset, right? How come we didn't know this, right? I would have slept a whole lot better at night had I known that we have this new system, right? Or this system that's in our body that can, it's just like a little salt and pepper. The virus comes in, this little protein gets attached to the antibody that's bound to the virus, and then we've got this massive machine that's spinning and digesting it. So if I get it correctly, you've got antibodies in your serum that are binding to the virus. It gets endocytosed. It means the virus goes into the cell coated with antibodies. The antibodies then bind to TRIM21, which is this protein that binds to it, labeling it for degradation, right? Because then TRIM21 gets this protein called ubiquitin. Ubiquitin because it's ubiquitous. It's in every organism ever, every eukaryotic organism. And it sucks it into the garbage, garbage trash compactor of the cell. So we've got this system, and we didn't know that we had this elaborate cellular-based immunity. That's pretty amazing that this slipped through our fingers.
Mark, that's why it's called research, right? Because we don't know everything.
There you go.
We didn't know what viral neutralization, exactly how it happened. All we knew was that it happened.
Well, we had some ideas.
And it involved an antibody, right?
We had some ideas. There were models. But these TRIM proteins have only been discovered in the past 10 years, mainly because of resistance of certain animals and cells to HIV-1 infection. So they're relatively new, and we're learning about their properties. And one of the properties is that they bind antibodies in the cytoplasm, which was only found last year. So, you know, that's how science goes, as you know. You learn new things, and what you thought you understood, you rediscover. So the way we thought antibodies work just wasn't right. Now, of course, it may not be that it turns out this is the way it works for all viruses and all antibodies, and that's something that needs to be sorted out. But I suspect, based on the properties of TRIM-21, it's going to account for a large fraction of neutralization. I think this could be one for the textbooks in the end.
Oh, cool. It's definitely going to the textbook. Here's a quick question for you. When you're making virus, say you're making influenza using Hep G2. I don't know what to use for influenza.
For a flu, you can throw it in canine kidney cells. That's what we often use.
And do the canine kidney cells have TRIM-21? And would you want to downregulate when you're doing a batch of influenza for vaccine?
Well, typically when you're growing a virus, there's no antibody around. You know, you use bovine serum that's free of antibodies, so you don't have to worry about that. If you had antibody for whatever reason, you could just downregulate TRIM-21 and that would take care of it, sure.
What I wonder is, why is this in PNAS and not in Nature?
That you have to ask the authors, you know. People have their own reasons for submitting to specific journals.
That's pretty wild. I mean, it's an incredible cellular process that we were completely unaware of.
But exactly. I think as Vincent was pointing out, you know, when he started off the talk, I mean, I think this is, you know, potentially a really interesting new line of therapy. Right? So in terms Absolutely. Of, you know, antiviral agents, if you could, you know, work on enhancing the TRIM-21 interaction...
Absolutely.
I think this could be a fruitful
basically
avenue.
Means that if you're making a vaccine, you should make sure that it induces TRIM-21 really well, right?
Yeah.
Because if it doesn't, you're not going to have as good a neutralizing response. So, you know, if it turns out for your vaccine, whatever it is that you're making, make sure you look at TRIM-21, and if it's not good, work on that. And I think that would really help a lot. So that's one of the practical outcomes of this, sure.
You could also Absolutely. Make it a fusion protein, possibly. So where you make you create your humanized antibody in a yeast system, and you've mm-hmm. got this human antibody produced in a yeast bioreactor, and you have it as a fusion protein to TRIM-21, you might be able to improve its potency.
Sure,
that's or maybe an interesting you could, thought.
Yeah, sure. There are all sorts of.
Let's take a minute. We'll thank our sponsor before we get on to some of the other stories. Thank you, Vincent, for
sure. Pleasure.
It's not every day you hear about major biological function being discovered, and that's a wild one. Our sponsor for this episode of Futures in Biotech is Kaleidograph. Kaleidograph is a thoughtfully designed graphing and data analysis application for research scientists, business professionals, and engineers. It produces publication quality graphs and easily converts the most complex data into a functional display. Statistics, linear, nonlinear curve fitting, and the ability to produce a precise graphic visualization of data all make Kaleidograph a powerful and flexible tool. Since 1988, Kaleidograph has been an easy to learn graphing and analysis program with a surprisingly affordable price. Try Kaleidograph for 45 days risk-free, and purchase Kaleidograph within the next 60 days, and you'll receive 20% discount if you purchase it. So visit www.synergy.com/podcast.htm. That's www.synergy.com/podcast.htm for details. Just a quick interesting story about Kaleidograph is that, man, I managed to get through my undergraduate, master's, PhD, and postdoc without learning Excel. Because I use Kaleidograph. Now, if you're going to do mathematics, right, and do data analysis, why would you use Excel? Does Excel do a double exponential decay curve fitting? No. It's got, Excel's been around since like 1985, 86, and you still can't, you know, just easily throw in an equation for curve fitting. I mean, you have to do linear, you have to do polynomial, and what else can it do?
George. Don't ask me. I'm not going near that program.
As a matter of fact, for the math, powerful mathematics, I've been able. You can just basically have your time course, your kinetic data, whatever the data is, and you can run it through a series of equations
that are in like this box, this little fun box where you have all your equations, press F2 to F3 to F4 to F5, F6. And then it translates your data through those equations. And the curve fitting is fantastic. The error bars are fantastic. And the best part is you can put the model that fits the physiology, that fits the biology, that fits the economics,
and
the
engineering. You know, I got to tell you something, Mark, just real quick. I mean, you know, for me personally, one of the reasons why I've kind of always stuck with Collidograph is just the ease with which you can put your favorite equation into the program. You know, really complicated nested cooperativity types of equations. Very easy to just pump that right in there and do a nice curve fit. So it's a lot, for me personally anyway, it's, you know, your favorite model, your favorite equation. It's really easy to just put it in there and get things going.
I've looked all over the place for apps. I'm running on a Mac. They have it for Windows and for Mac. And I've looked for a solution that we can use across the board because we have Mac and Windows machines. And so we use it every day for data analysis. We run all our cell-based assays through it, and it gives us the great statistics that we need. So I'd like to thank them for sponsoring Futures in Biotech. All right. So let's get on. This is going to be a fun story. In that, as soon as I suggested we do a panel show, Andre said, this is the paper I want to pick. And then we just turned around and said, well, let's see if Mark's available to talk about it. And he was. Mark Gerstein from Yale. So we have Andre Nantel and Mark Gerstein. So Andre, I'll let you introduce the paper.
All right. So the paper I decided to talk about was published in Nature last October, on October 28th. And the title of the paper is A Map of Human Genome Variation from Population Scale Sequencing. And it was published by a group that calls itself the 1000 Genomes Project Consortium. Just to give you a little background information, the human genome have approximately 3 billion DNA base pairs and codes for about 25,000 proteins. And a significant proportion of what we call the reference genomic sequence for human actually comes from two old white males, Craig Venter and James Watson. We already know that if you go from one human to another, about 99% of the DNA is identical. That sounds like an impressive level of homogeneity, but 1% of 3 billion, that's 30 million mutations. And these mutations define who we are, and they define our predisposition to a variety of diseases, whether we're going to react to certain drugs. And understanding these links between genome variation and disease and drug responses and who we are is one of the big promise of the Human Genome Project. So the mutations you're going to find in the human genomes, they really come in three flavors. And these are words you're going to hear a lot during this discussion. You're going to hear about SNPs. SNPs, or SNPs, means single nucleotide polymorphisms. That's just one base pair differences between two alleles or two people in the same region of the genome. You're going to hear about indels, which stands for insertions and deletions. So these are essentially larger fragments that are either present or absent when you're comparing different genome variants. And you also hear about copy number variations. These are repeated sequences that go like blink, 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 blink. Same sequence repeated in a variety number, variable number of times. That's also sometimes important in diseases. That's used a lot for PCR-based identification in CSI shows and whatnot. So these cause genetic variations. Sometimes these genetic variants will affect simple traits, like one base pair change is commonly linked to certain diseases like cystic fibrosis, Huntington, muscular dystrophy. But very often, you're going to have a lot of genes having very mild effect that together will define complex traits like heart disease, diabetes, cancer. And to be able to link all of these mutations to complex traits, you need to know what is normal. What is the distributions of genetic mutations, not just in old white males, but in the general population?
Touché.
Yeah. In about 2008, we had essentially a publication of the HapMap project, which is the haplotype haplotype mapping project whose goal was to map these sequence variations. And right now, their database includes about 11 million SNPs and maybe 3 million indels. And they were trying to link this information to a variety of clinical informations and populations and whatnot. And over the past 5 years, association studies have already identified several thousand mutations that could be associated to disease susceptibility or other common traits. So that's the basics. Now, the project itself,
This is Mark. Can I just chime in one thing? You did a great job summarizing this. I think one thing, though, that's key to mention is that the 1 in 100 number, I would actually say it's a little bit lower. It's more like 1 in 1,000 for the variance between people. It's about 3 million or something like that, as opposed to 30.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And it's okay. Actually, it's a useful number to know is that it's 1 in 100. Well, 1 in 100 is us versus a chimp. So if you look at a chimpanzee and a person, it's about 1 every 100 changes is bases are changed.
Although I read that if you include indels, that percentage goes down by a significant number. It's more
that's
than right. just.
No, that's a very good. No, that's correct. You're correct. Actually, that's exactly right. You're correct. You're correct. It's actually one of the issues that's actually quite interesting. I'll let you finish your summary, is the fraction of things in the SNPs versus the indels and copy number variations.
Okay. So the 1,000 Genome Project was officially launched in 2008. And to just read directly what their goal is to discover genotypes and provide accurate haplotype information on all forms of human DNA polymorphisms in multiple human populations. So the goal, their avowed goal is to characterize over 90% of the variants that are in genomic regions that are accessible to high throughput sequencing. And they want to do this in each of the 5 major population groups, which essentially are population whose ancestry is from Europe, East Asia, South Asia, West Africa, and the Americas. And by doing that, they're essentially putting together large genomic centers. We're talking about the Sanger Institute in the UK, BGI Shenzhen in China, the National Human Genome Research Institute in Maryland, as well as many other sequencing centers to do whole genome sequencing on thousands of human samples.
The San Francisco Technorati, their genomes. Sorry.
Well, the question I'm going to ask Mark is how they chose whose genome they're going to sequence. But we're about to get to that. One number that I think is really scary is that once they're done in a few years, the data set is going to include 6 trillion DNA bases. That's 60 times more sequence data than what has been published in DNA databases in the past 25 years. If you think GenBank is useless right now, just wait.
All right. You read my mind.
Dr. Gernstein, so I'm going to ask a couple of questions I have for you is, how does this project get started? Who had the idea to do this? How did they get their money? And what, in your case, what is your specific role in this consortium and how did you get involved in this?
Sure. Well, I think that the thing that led to the project is a number of things. I mean, ostensibly, to some degree, this is an outgrowth of the HapMap project and also the Copy Number Consortium, which was looking at copy number variations. But more practically, I think that there's been this tremendous excitement to do with personal genomics and next-generation sequencing. And I think that this project is really, in some sense, the kind of official NHGRI version of personal genomics, trying to think about the genome sequence in terms of individuals and so forth. And I should just mention that there's another NHGRI project called ENCODE, which I'm part of as well, that is really the aim is the annotation of the genome. And so to some degree, if you want to interpret the human genome, you really kind of need 2 things. You need to understand the variation between people, and you also need to understand the functional elements and the annotation of the genome. And so you can kind of see it as a sort of logical outgrowth of you know, the genomic activities in general. Do you want me to continue with what my particular role in this is, or should I?
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. So, this is a very large project. I don't know how many authors, frankly, there are on the paper, and I doubt I've even met a few percentage of the authors. It's kind of scary how many people are involved in this. I don't think there's 1,000, but I think it's a few hundred authors of the paper. But I got involved in this mostly because I was interested in two distinct genomic things. One was structural variations and copy number variations in the genome, and I've developed a lot of methods for finding these variations. And so a subpart of the Thousand Genomes Project is called the Structural Variation Group, and so I participated in this subgroup. And that group has found the thousands of structural variations that are in an ordinary person, and also really developed a lot of methods for this. Structural variation, a lot of people would say, is the most complicated part of genome variation, and maybe in the most significant, though that's kind of very much debated. And the other thing I've kind of been quite involved with is I have a longstanding interest in dead genes or pseudogenes, and through that kind of connection, I got involved in another part of the project, which is called the loss of function component. And so one of the interesting things about 1,000 genomes is there are millions of mutations in an individual, but of course only a very small number impact genes, and even a smaller number actually really hurt genes. But it turns out that it's quite appreciable, so you're talking about, in the average individual, a few hundred genes that are disabled. And so they essentially become dead in that person. And so one question that immediately comes to mind, if you sequence that individual, what do you call those things? Do you call them genes, or are they pseudogenes? Because if you only had sequenced that one individual, you wouldn't realize that those things which are disabled are actually functioning genes. And so this definition of what actually constitutes a functioning gene in the human genome, or more generally in the human population, is actually becoming a bit ambiguous, you know, because everyone doesn't actually have the exact same complement of genes. And I'm quite interested in this latter question, and that's how the second way I got involved in this this project.
We had this issue of what exactly is a gene, even in a simpler organism like yeast, when I was working on the Candida albicans genome. All right, so the goal here is to sequence DNA from a variety of individuals. So how do you choose whose individual the genomes are going to get sequenced? Do you have any clue on that?
Me.
Well, no, that's a very interesting question. So, I mean, I'm not involved. I'm obviously involved in the downstream mathematical and computational analyses, and not so much involved in the sample collection. Practically, the individuals that they've sequenced really are the individuals that were chosen by the HapMap project. Okay, and so these individuals actually were chosen a long time ago. In fact, it's quite fascinating. Some of the individuals being sequenced are part of these called trios, which means they're families, their father, mother, and child. And actually, they're even generations, they're even grandchildren. So these people have been selected over time as part of the HapMap project. And one of the most important things about 1,000 genomes is that the people have consented for this information to be put out freely on the web. And so one of the things that makes 1,000 genomes a very special resource is that you can download this data and do whatever you want with it. And you can analyze it to your heart's content. And that's a very important thing, because obviously this is highly personal information that we're dealing with, right? This is...
Sorry to interrupt a sec. There's something that you jumped out at me here. You said, you know, father, mother, and child. That's two genomes, right? So... I don't know, is this
really? No, that's exactly correct. No, that's precisely correct. And so that's why they were chosen, because you can use the relationship, that was called trio relationship between the parents, to really understand what's going on in the child's genome. And it's fascinating, right? Because you can see in that child's genome, literally, you can see the mother and father's genome. And more practically, you do something called phasing. You can actually phase the haplotypes in the child's genome using the parent's genome. So it's a very powerful... The relationships are very powerful in this context.
What's also fun, that's actually one of the output of the paper, is you can almost also measure how a genome drifts from generation to generation, because you have the parents' genome, you have the kid's genome. So any additional mutation the kid picked up must have been picked up during gametogenesis. And I think the number was, it wasn't too high. It was something like 10 to the minus 8. So you're talking maybe about 30 mutations per generation, but these add up.
Yeah, so that was of great interest in the project, these what's called de novo events. And, you know, it's particularly, that number is very interesting. I mean, how many de novo events do you have in a normal offspring? And one of the things that's a little tricky in that estimate is, unfortunately, the project mostly dealt with cell lines. These are immortalized cell lines. And so they're not exactly sure these are representative of the variation you'd have in the normal individual. And, you know, so for instance, the actual estimate they have of 10 to the minus 8th is from ruling out lots of other variants they found that they call cell line artifacts. And so one of the big things they're hoping to do in the next phase of the project is actually use not use cell lines, just use blood samples directly.
Okay, we'll talk about the next phase of the project a little bit later on. So let's just concentrate on the content of this paper, because this paper is not the output of the whole project. It's what essentially is a pilot project to validate the technologies and see if the analysis methods that they were planning to use would be appropriate. And essentially, this project had three objectives. We've already talked about one of them. That was the trios, the family, nuclear family group, father, mother, and child. You also had low coverage sequencing of 179 individuals from three geographic groups, and the exon sequencing of a much larger number of individuals, 697, to really see the type of gene variations they would see inside of genes. Each project, I think what I would propose is to go over each subgroup individually. And if Dr. Gernstein, if you want to go over the main conclusions of each section. So we've talked about the trios result. Do you want to go over the discoveries of the low coverage sequencing?
Sure. Well, I would say that I think that's a great way that you're putting that. But I just, as preface, I just useful to point out that the way that these things were phrased is they were called, as you were saying, pilot projects. There were three pilots. But actually, in actual fact, the real project is really more of a synthesis of the pilot one, the low coverage sequencing of the large number of individuals. And really the point of the other two pilots to some degree is to see how they can bolster and make more accurate the pilot one low coverage sequencing.
Yeah, there was a lot of questions about accuracy.
Yes, correct. That's exactly right. I mean, a lot of thousand genomes is a very detailed statistical discussion of, you know, how little money can you spend to sequence someone and still determine all their variations. That's really what it comes down to. And so what they believe they can get away with is to sequence these individuals at fairly low coverage, you know, whether I think it's about 4x, which is considerably lower coverage than most of the personal genome sequence has done, and yet determine most of their variants with high accuracy. And that's actually quite an impressive statistical achievement.
So one of the big things that came out of that paper, and that's the question, right, is how many mutations are we carrying? If I would essentially have a child with myself, would it live?
No. So I'm sorry, can I interject a quick question?
Sure, sure.
I'm just wondering, in terms of you know, personal genomics, is it really necessary to sequence a person's entire genome, or can we simplify things and just go for those coding sequence that or genes that we know have protein products?
Well, that's an interesting question, and that's been historically one of the more controversial aspects of genomics. I mean, initially they didn't even want to sequence the human genome because they were like, well, what, most of it's junk, right? You know, it's 99% of the human genome is kind of non-coding, and so why don't we just focus on the genes? But what people have found historically is that when you really look at it, that supposed junk is actually quite functional. It has lots of the variants in it, and lots of the variants that are linked to disease. And I think that the message that's coming out more and more is that you really can't shortcut things. And the reason you can't is, first of all, most of the variants that are interesting to people are not purely within exons or genes. Second of all, you might say to yourself, another shortcut that you didn't mention, but it's also people tried to get to think about, was using what's called LD structure, Lincoln's disequilibrium structure. And this is a little harder to explain, but it was sort of the idea behind HapMap, where you would, you can get most of the common variants very easily. And most of the variants are linked, they're kind of correlated together on chromosomes. But it turns out that a lot of the rare variants are actually really important. And people are starting to think more and more that, well, you know, even if you get all the common variants and even the sort of less, somewhat less common things as 1,000 genomes, that's not even enough. You really have to have all of the true mutations in a person to really understand what's going on. Because a lot of the rare variants that a person has are often maybe, or perhaps might be, the thing that really leads to that person's disabilities, diseases, and whatnot.
So how many variants do you expect from one person to the next then?
Well, the estimate in 1,000 genomes, and like I said, this is all estimate stuff, is it's about 3 million. Well, no, take it back. I should be careful because you corrected me originally. So most of the variation discussion is really focused on SNPs initially. And so the number that they put out there is about 3 million. And it's a little complicated. You know, are you comparing to Europeans? Are you comparing a European to an African and so forth? But a good number to keep in the back of your mind is 3 million. And then, of course, those are single nucleotide polymorphisms. But there's also indels and structural variants. And there's a lot of indels in the genome, and they range in size from simple one base pair indel to, you know, 50 base pair, you know, kind of cut. And there's imagined to be about...
What do you mean by indel, by the way?
Insertion deletions.
Oh, insertion deletions. Okay.
Yeah. So an indel would be a missing bases. And you can see, actually, even though they haven't been focused on as much, you can see they're potentially much more disruptive. Because clearly, if you have a one base pair indel anywhere in a gene or a something functioning, you're going to kill that in a second. You're going to just create a frame shift, and it's going to be tremendously deleterious to it. Keep going.
Okay, that was actually a number that I found very impressive when I read, in the sense that they've identified almost 2 million new indels in this data set that they looked at, and they were looking at any of those are essentially creating mutations that would cause a gene to stop working. And each of us in our genome has as many as 250 to 300 of these mutations. 50 to 100 of them have already been associated with a disease. So, I mean, that's a lot of mutation. Thank God we're diploids. What else would be
We have TRIM 21. Are you saying 200 to 300... indels or insertion deletion mutations in everybody? Yeah. How am I going to sleep tonight?
Well, no, not necessarily deletions, but genetic changes that break the gene sequence. And half of them we already know are causing disease. I mean, essentially most of these genes were heterozygous. So we have a functional gene in our genome. But in this case, well, you know that idea you had of marrying your cousin? Not a good idea, because they probably have the same.
The TRIM 21 comment, maybe we can bring this close to home since we just talked about that story. Here we have an opportunity now to see 1,000 different TRIM 21s and see the variation among different populations. And then you can go in the lab and introduce them in the protein and see the effect on neutralization of infectivity. So that's an example of what you can do when you have all that information.
Absolutely.
You know, it's very, very interesting, I think, to have that variation. And one other thing that is also interesting, just to point out, if you for just looking at TRIM 21 or what the project aims to do, is you have the actual sequence variants that you get in TRIM 21, and that immediately quite useful if you're just looking at one gene. But what you also get, and is not appreciated as much, is you get what's called the allele frequencies in the population, and the allele frequencies that differ between different populations. And those allele frequencies are very interesting, because if they're very rare or very common, you immediately get a sense of how advantageous or unadvantageous a given mutation is. You know, so a lot of very rare variants, you don't even have to understand biochemically what they do. You kind of know that these variants are going to be screwing something up. And if you actually walk through the calculations quite carefully, you can even go farther to say, are these variants under what's called positive selection? That means they're kind of under adaptive evolution, or they're kind of changing rapidly in the human population, or are they under purifying selection and are, you know, really kind of very deleterious to change and so forth? It's actually the frequency data quite useful.
So is that information going to be easily available in databases like Unigene, for example? So whenever you have your favorite gene, you get its sequence. If you get 1,000 sequences, that's not useful. But if you get, this is the reference sequence, and these are all the mutations you can find. If it's in something that, let's call it, the average biologist can have access very quickly, it could be tremendously useful.
Well, that's the goal. The goal is to make that information, also, like I said, these frequencies in various populations available. And one of the challenges that the project has is how to make the information available to people so that it's useful. Because all of the reads are available for you to download, but it's literally terabases, if not almost fractions of a petabyte, frankly, to download the entire project data. And clearly that's not what someone's going to want to do. And so the question is how to provide summaries that people find useful and, you know, for their research.
Let me take the quick question from 37,000 feet here. Okay, so it seems like you have two approaches, right? Because understanding genetic variation and correlating it to disease is really, really important. And you take the three major diseases, right? Cancer, heart disease, or heart disease, cancer, and stroke, in that order, right? Killing or causing the premature death of about 1.5 billion people, right? So you tackle these, you save 1.5 billion people. So you look at the genetic variation. Do you do it from the people that are in the hospital with the disease, sequence their genomes, and try to correlate to the forms that lead to disease, or you just do random genome sequencing of the entire population, which is very costly, and then try to look at their histories as an after fact? It seems like I would do the entire genome and just do it once, do the human genome, right? All the human genome, every single 13 billion. I don't know, which way is going to be the best approach? I guess you guys are definitely trying the first 1,000, right? It's getting cheaper.
Well, it is interesting. I mean, this is a really interesting question. You know, what's going to happen in the future with personal genomics? And, you know, I mean, one of the really amazing things is, of course, the cost of the sequencing has just dropped so ridiculously that people can essentially fantasize now about sequencing everyone's genome or people's genomes being trivially available. And what would that mean in terms of medicine and just in terms of their thinking about their identity? I think people are going to do all sorts of approaches. I mean, I think that there's going to be targeted sequencing, obviously, of individuals that have particular phenotypes or disease. And there's also going to be a lot of stuff like 1,000 genomes where you're just looking at variation in the population, or you're doing it in a less directed fashion, because I think that's also extremely useful too. I think my personal thing, I'll just toss out just really quick to... But I think what your people are going to really find, I think, very soon, is one of the major issues that I'm particularly keen on is a lot of this sort of privacy and identity issues. I mean, it's easy to say you want to sequence someone's genome, or someone who's sick is going to have this done, but it's a tremendously invasive thing if you think about it for a second. And I think that soon that's going to become a bit of a limitation. I mean, I don't think everyone's going to really consent to participating in this and putting their data freely available.
That's interesting. You know, your perspective from Andres would be completely different. He lives in a country that has universal health care for everyone as a right, and you live in a country where it's a privatized system, and then if you get it out that you have a precondition, you're in trouble, right?
Yeah, I don't think it's so much an inch. I mean, I don't think there's the insurance angle, but I also just think it's a pure discussion of individual privacy. I mean, it's a question of do you want to walk around on the street with your clothes on or not? I mean,
right,
quite
good
literally.
Naked and bad naked.
Well, one last question before I think we're going to have to move on, right, Mark? I mean, time is moving short.
Yeah.
Just a quick question, Mark. No plant survives contact with the enemy. That's an old adage. So have the result of the pilot project led to any significant changes in the overall research plan of the 1,000 Genome Project?
Oh, yes. No, I think that's definitely been the case. I mean, I mean, one of the things that happened to the pilot that we didn't discuss, but which was quite exciting, was there was a lot of different sequencing technologies used. So, for instance, there was you probably heard of Illumina sequencing. There was also sequencing from Solid. There was sequencing from 454.
And yeah, which machine should I buy?
Yes. Well, I think the project has decided, it's not clear everyone necessarily agrees with this, but the project has very strongly endorsed very monolithic Illumina sequencing. And, you know, a lot of the initial discussion of different technologies has kind of faded away a bit. And it's very clear that it's, you know, pretty much going to go with Illumina. But there is a lot of discussion, too, about how to best get at these structural variants or more complicated rearrangements in the genome. And so there's been a lot of discussion about how to do that. And that's much more kind of in the state of play at the moment as to what should happen.
All right. Thank you very much, Mark.
Sure. Before we move off, I just want to leave this story with a virus sort of perspective. And this sort of gets to George's earlier comment about just sequencing certain parts, coding regions. We know that up to 40% of the genome is retro elements, things related to retroviruses. You know, 8% of the sequence is endogenous or integrated retroviral genome. So when we have sequences from so many people in so many different ethnic groups and so forth, we can start to trace how these have moved around when they entered the genomes. Even though they're dead, they're not making viruses, we can tell when they first infected and so forth. So I think that's another good argument to sequence everything. And it's also another aspect. It's another aspect of the sequence, which maybe not all of you are thinking about, but in the end, by analyzing it, can really provide a lot of interesting information.
So sure, we really want to sequence our junk, right?
Yeah, I mean, supposedly, right? They don't do anything, but they give you information on when the infections took place, how long ago, and so forth, and how they moved across continents. So it can be very useful.
Yeah, what I would just actually say that those virals, or supposedly viral sequences or junk sequences, they're actually amongst the most useful things for tracing ancestry and really understanding the relatedness of people, even more useful than genes, actually. And also, the way they hop around the genome is actually quite useful in terms of, or not useful, but it has a tremendous effect in terms of functional relevance, in terms of they affect genes quite a bit in terms of their way they insert themselves and so forth. I just wanted to add that. Okay.
So it's pretty amazing. I think it's revolutionizing medicine, our ability to do these incredibly large genomics projects, because, you know, I do want to know what the what genetic preconditions one, you know, I might have and my family. I want to know that if my child has one of my evil 200 or 300 deletions, that we can prepare him and get him the medication, the personalized medication that he might need, or in gene therapy that he might need in 20 years. So, you know, it's incredible. So thank you, Mark, for doing that work and really, you know, with all your energy going after it. That's really cool. We just had an emergency in the lab. I think we had a CO2 tank.
Yeah, or a person that we share some lab space with.
Oh, it's hers.
Her incubator, yeah. Yeah. Sorry. It's down to about 1%.
Oh, she can put her stuff in our incubator.
Yeah. But it's okay. We just switched up the tanks. Good. It's not a big deal. Yeah.
I was like, uh-oh. Okay, we're doing a show. But okay. So we can get right into the third story. We started late, but we have a little bit of time left. We're doing okay on time, Burke?
Yeah. We have till 2:30.
Till 2:30. Okay, so we have a half hour.
Well, actually, but more about 2:15.
Okay, so we got 15 minutes. So let's talk about the Human Proteome Project. There was a call to science by John Bergeron, Tommy Nielsen, Matthias Mann, Rudy Abersold, John Yates, Amos Baroque. These are phenomenal scientists doing incredible work in a new area called proteomics. And they are suggesting, John mentioned that he was applying for a $1 billion grant to get several countries on board to do the human proteome. So there's a lot of pros and cons. And the way I see doing the human proteome, it's our first, and sorry, Andre, but for the Star Trek reference, but it's running the human body
through our first tricorder, even though it's going to be hundreds of labs, thousands of people working on it, it will be the first atomic level scan of the entire human body. So it is a tricorder run, but a $1 billion tricorder run, and at the current state of technology, very, very, very costly in terms of funds, time, energies, may divert us from from important science that might be going on. But these guys, they know their stuff. And they're suggesting that we go ahead and do the human proteome. So maybe, George, you could tell us a little bit about your take on this.
Well, you know, they really want to go out there and basically take a fingerprint of what's going on inside of all the cells in the human body. I think that, you know, this is a commentary from a group of guys that are all really outstanding mass spectroscopists. I mean, they've all done a lot of serious development. And it comes after a commentary that came from the Human Proteome Organization back in February, where they outlined essentially three goals that they want to achieve. First, they want to put together a protein encyclopedia. So they want at least one representative of each human gene, a protein product, its abundance and its modifications. So that's sort of their first step, their first goal. The second goal that they want to achieve is they want to basically look at protein. They want to generate a protein distribution atlas. So basically, what's the tissue distribution and the subcellular localization of each of these individual proteins? And then finally, they want to basically develop the protein pathway, sort of a network map of how all of these different proteins interact with each other. And this group of guys in this article that we're talking about today, they basically want to say to everybody that's doing proteomics and everybody that's interested in putting together the human proteome, they want to say to everybody, look, the mass spectrometer is ready to go. And I think it's fair to say, and I think most people in this discussion would agree, that the mass spectrometer is absolutely fantastic in terms of if you send a very complicated mixture of peptides into that mass spectrometer, it is extremely efficient and extremely powerful at identifying all of the peptides that it can.
And being parts of protein.
Yeah, pieces of protein. So I guess I should just kind of give you a quick overview of how shotgun proteomics work. So let's say you have some tissue. You grind up that, and you want to know all of the proteins that are in that tissue.
Diseased versus non-diseased?
That's one thing that you could take to try to see if, you know, what are the specific proteins that are involved in production of that particular disease state. Although, admittedly, to date, nobody's really ever been able to take a diseased state series of cell or tissue and non-diseased tissue and really been able to tease out exactly what proteins are causing the disease state using this sort of shotgun proteomics approach.
Let me take a quick interjection here because we've got to put this into context.
Yeah, for sure.
The Human Genome Project was about sequencing this fixed state. Well, it's somewhat dynamic. It's changing. But if you take an individual like Craig Venner, sequence his genome, that's his genome, right? But if you're doing the proteome, you're sequencing the products of the genome, which are rapidly changing, right? And so you could have a situation where, the proteins that you have, you're growing extra hair because you're outside in the cold. You're 4 years old versus you're 7 years old, different proteins. You've got different tissue types, cell cycle, time of day. Just thinking about lunch means that you have a different set of proteins, right?
It's extremely, it's a completely different level of complication. And with all due respects to the genomics guys in the discussion here, and please correct me if I'm wrong, the example that I'd like to use when comparing genomics with proteomics in terms of the degree of complexity is looking back to this old tradition that my family had on New Year's Eve. Somebody would always purchase one of these 1,000-piece puzzles. And every time they would pull this puzzle out, everybody would just groan, but we would all, you know, do our duty and try to help put together this massive puzzle. And, you know, when you get one of these huge puzzles, the first thing that you do is you spill out all of the pieces and you flip them all over right side up and you start organizing them. And the way I kind of think about genomics is genomics has helped us identify all of those pieces in the puzzle. Mm-hmm. And what proteomics is going to help us do is it's going to help us figure out what's the shape, what's the size, and how do all of these pieces fit together. Now, imagine the human body has something like, what is it? I think it's a couple of hundred different tissue types, 200-some-odd different tissue types. So you're going to have 200-some-odd different puzzles that probably are much more complex than this sort of two-dimensional puzzle. Probably there are three dimensions to it. And so the level of complexity just expands, I think, exponentially.
So,
and
George, is this going to be done on all the tissues, or is it initially just cells? What's the starting material on this?
So what they would like to do is they would like to do all of the tissues in the human body and all of the bodily fluids as well that come from humans. I think absolutely. They want it all.
They can't do that from a living person, though, right? If they can, you can get a biopsy of every tissue from a living person.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is a very key point, I think.
We're going to need to do a brain biopsy.
A very key discrepancy to this whole thing is that, you know, I mean, this is going to have to be done on cadavers. I mean,
cadaver, it's going to be totally different from a live person, right? And maybe not relevant at all.
One thing that's useful to mention, this is Mark, I just want to add that think it's different, the proteome, but there is also a lot of people in genomics who are doing these body map RNA sequencing, where they're sequencing essentially every single tissue of the RNA, which is kind of the intermediate between the proteome and the genome. So this is kind of, I think it's useful to also point that out.
Sure, and I'm really happy that you pointed this out, Mark, because there's a really big difference between, you know, on the front end of the experiment, you can take a tiny sample, a tiny biopsy, if you will, from all sorts of different tissues in a living person's body, and not really significantly impair normal function. And with that tiny amount of material, it's possible to do RNA sequencing because you're able to amplify the RNA from each of those different types of tissue. Whereas when we talk about proteomics, you need a much bigger sample because you don't have this ability to amplify the amount of material that you're given to begin with. You have a very finite amount of material and you have to try to identify all of the proteins from a very tiny amount of material for which you have no way of amplifying the amount of starting material. So it's a big, big difference it's something that's definitely going to, I think, hamper the proteome project.
But it's kind of like the situation right now where you can imagine they've discovered the microscope and it's 1790 or early 1800s, and they start dissecting the human body to the individual cells and then start developing stains and isolate the various organelles in terms of structures and start piecing together the human anatomy. Now we have the technology. We have the mass spectrometer, and we can go in and dissect the human anatomy to the next level, to the atomic level, right? But it's really, really costly. But the information would be really amazing to have.
Before the human genome was done, they tried out the technology with some bacterial genomes, right? And to make sure everything. So maybe they should try this with a mouse or a rat or a rabbit first and do all the tissues in there. You don't have this issue of biopsying and getting enough material.
No, I this is Mark. I agree with that. Another thing that they could do, though, is they could also just focus on these kind of RNA atlases of people and then really try to understand the relationship between the RNA abundance and the protein abundance in a particular controlled system, and then you perhaps wouldn't need as much of the protein data, you know, in all the different tissues.
I mean, you know, there's the proteomics people will always fall back on, you know, the fact that the correlation between the amount of RNA that you have and the amount of protein that's in a cell at any given time, the correlation is terrible. Because, you know, there's the rate of synthesis and there's the rate of degradation of the protein. But, I mean, I think as you're suggesting, perhaps if a bunch of time was spent in a mouse or other animals trying to work out, you know, how well you can make that correlation, if you can at all, would be useful.
Mm.
Yeah, but, you know, this is $1 billion. And to all the countries in the world, it's the slice of pizza for all the individuals, right? So, you know, it's kind of like our moon project, if we were going to do it, right? Our moon mission. Worthwhile to do. The RNA, for the audience that might have missed what they were, you know, kind of saying on in terms of RNA, you can look at what genes are being turned on by looking at the transcripts off the genome, which is the ribonucleic acids. And then if you sequence those, they tell you which genes are on and off. So you can know what information is being turned on. Right, but you can also just look at the proteins. Those are, of course, the products of the whole process of you know, DNA makes RNA, then RNA is used to make protein. So you could definitely lower the cost of how many times you have to repeat and improve your data set by correlating it to gene expression, which is much easier to and much cheaper to sequence than to fly these proteins, digest them up, and fly them through mass spectrometer, right?
The other thing you can do, too, just to finish that, is there's a lot of other projects that are looking at what's called the epigenome, which is even sits between, you know, the genome and the RNA, where you can kind of systematically see which parts of the genome are turned on and turned off in different cell types. And, you know, there's a lot of intermediate steps you can do before you go to the kind of final proteome of looking at all the particular proteins that are there in a particular cell.
So let's take a vote. Let's go around the table. Do we do it? George?
Well, I think that there are some... I think in addition to this, the issue of how you're going to get this sample and whether or not you really have the sensitivity to deal with incredibly tiny amounts of material... I think there are a bunch of additional very serious technical issues that, you know, come in that really kind of cloud the issue for me a bit. I think it's a little bit early to go after a complete catalog of the proteome in all tissue types. I think that it might be a good idea to really get serious about looking at those tissues that we have and bodily fluids that we have ready access to that aren't going to hurt somebody. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can look at muscle, you can look at cardiac muscle if you want to, you can look at a portion of a person's liver, various other tissues that you can pull out in probably sufficient quantities to look at with proteomics and really pull things apart. I think it's definitely I believe strongly that the mass spectrometer is up to the job. Whether or not a lot of these techniques that come before the mass spectrometer are truly up to the job is a little bit unclear to me. And if you guys will just let me digress for just a second, I'll tell you part of the reason why. One of the things that comes into play here is looking at specific proteins. You know, you need to sort of increase the amount of protein that you're interested in studying with proteomics. And so what people typically will do is a pull-down experiment or an affinity capture. And frequently what you use is an antibody. And I've done this type of experiment looking at superoxide dismutase in a mouse model of basically ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. And interestingly, when you do this experiment, this type of pull-down with an antibody specifically to that protein, one of the proteins that I saw in pretty decent abundance that I always sort of scratched my head about was this protein TRIM21. I wonder where that came from. So, I mean, here it is, Vincent. I'm using an antibody, just a generic IgG, and it pulled down a whole bunch of TRIM21 along with it. So... with these antibody approaches, you know, the antibody is not necessarily just going to bind the protein that for which it has, you know, a binding site to. It's also going to pull down other associated proteins like, you know, TRIM21. If there's any there, it's probably going to bind the antibody. In addition to that, there are all sorts of other sort of non-specific sticking issues to the resin and so forth and so on that really kind of cloud things for me. But I think in the end, in terms of just sort of whole proteome identification of proteins and so forth, I think for those organs, for those tissues that we have ready access to, I say, yeah, I think we should go ahead with it.
Andre, Mark, yes, no?
I personally, I think that the political economic atmosphere right now is not very conducive to a $1 billion biological moonshot. It is values.
Oh man, Andre, it's without.
I'm a realist.
Form, we don't have function without form. We don't have function, and we need to figure this out.
Oh, it'll keep. I'm not saying they should stop doing proteomics, and they'll still be going to be done in thousands of different labs. Sure. But convincing funding agencies, government to fund another mega project when the Human Genome Project, even though it's brought in a lot of things, didn't exactly bring in the things we were promised to get. We're still getting there, but the Genome Project data was so complex for us to understand how a single cancerous tumor is different from a normal tumor. And we're coming in and proposing to have even more complex data.
You can't jump in the pool, though. And this is,
I know. I'm not saying we shouldn't do it. I'm just saying I'll be surprised if the money is there.
Mark, you'd have a much better case if you did it with a mouse. It'd probably cost 10 times less. You'd work out all the approaches. Sure. You could say, look, this is what we're going to get. And then you make a really good case for doing it with people. I think that would be the way to go here.
Well,
the Genome Project started with model organisms, and they learned a lot from them.
Exactly. John?
So you want to bridge the gap, right? And I think that's probably a fair approach, Vincent, you know, sort of bridge the gap. You know, there are a whole bunch of different disease states, you know, disease models that we have in mice. Let's study the mice proteome.
Sure.
Well, and there's a lot of protein modifications that we don't even know how common they are. Everybody's looking at phosphorylation, but you got sumo, you got ubiquitin, you got 20 types of different ubiquitin-like proteins that we barely know what their functions are. So I'd say figure them out in a simpler organism like yeast or mouse or Drosophila, whatnot, and then move on to human.
Yeah, well, okay. I'll agree to wait a little bit, but we're going to have John Bergeron on in January, and he wants me to pull in John Yates and Matthias Mann on board.
Wait a second. What about Mark? What do you think, Mark?
Yeah. This is Mark with a K. Yep. I would slightly disagree in the sense that, first of all, I would say that when we've been talking about proteomics, you've been emphasizing just the abundance of the proteins and just their exact constitution. But the other thing you get from proteomics, which is really special, that you don't get from genomics, of course, is the interactions and the connections between things. And those are really quite special. And you're not going to ever get that from a lot of the genomics. And so I would sort of argue that I do think that, you know, a huge protein interaction map or a huge proteomics endeavor aimed at these networks is really a unique thing. And you might say, well, why can't we do this in a mouse? Why can't we do it in a fly? And I would argue that a lot of the networks and connections between things are even more specific to an organism than, say, the genome sequence. And so the idea is that I don't really think that the human networks are going to be that similar to even those things in a mouse. And so you really have to study them, I would argue, in a human. So and the other thing about these projects, just to finally say, is that they're incremental, right? So if you just start and you pile up data, I mean, the data that you pile up doesn't go away, right? You just keep piling it up. And, you know, eventually you'll get to this endpoint, which is complete coverage.
Well, you know, you combine the 1,000 genomes with the one human proteome, and then eventually the 1,000 human proteomes, and then everybody gets their proteome done. We're going to be in an incredible place in terms of saving and lives and improving quality of life for millions, right? So I say we go for it. Start with the mouse, move it forward. Hey, before we go, we don't have very much time. I really wanted to talk about the trapped anti-hydrogen paper that just came out yesterday. I always, when we do these panel shows, we'll check CNN and see if there's any big news. And while there always seems to be these massive projects that get
launch the day we do the panel. So have you guys heard about it? They're sort of working on what they did is they managed to trap anti-hydrogen, right? And what's really cool about it, well, here's why they did it. They wanted to test a standard model of elementary particles and interactions called the they want to set it up so that they can study it, the charge conjugation parity time reversal theorem. And they also want to check that the anti-hydrogen have the same and hydrogen have the same spectrum, right? So that's why they did it. They're sort of the near possible use of their system. And so this is the first time, you know, they've purified, or they're not purified, but they've been able to get anti-hydrogen. We're talking antimatter here. But it was not confined. What these guys did is they managed to put a large, large magnet together. It's called the Alpha apparatus. It's an atom trap magnet with a modular annihilation detector and a Penning trap electrodes. I'm probably not pronouncing correctly. We're using a 1T magnet, and they were able to trap the anti-hydrogen. And then what they would do is release the magnet. And their magnet had the incredible ability of dropping its field in 9 milliseconds, which is unprecedented. They've never been able to do this. This is orders of magnitude quicker. And then by releasing the magnetic field, the anti-hydrogen then smacks against the side, and they measure and detect the annihilation, right? So they basically were able to trap 38 atoms of anti or anti-atoms of antimatter, right? This is pretty wild. They did the experiment 335 times at CERN. I certainly think it's worth mentioning. It's not biotech, but, man, they were able to trap antimatter. Just think about the science. They'd go to anti-hydrogen, then anti-carbon, anti-uranium, right?
What so how long did they trap them, Mark?
They trapped them for over 9 milliseconds, right? Because then they were able to detect it. So longer than 9 milliseconds. But no, I think it was 0.17 seconds. And, you know, just reading the paper, right? Let me take a quote from the paper here. Here's how they did it specifically. Antiprotons and positrons are made to interact in a nested, well, axial potential at the center of a magnetic atom trap. After the two species are placed in their respective potential wells, the superconducting magnets of the atom trap are ramped up to their maximum fields in 25 seconds. The antiprotons are then excited into the positron plasma using an oscillating electric field that auto-resonantly increases their energy. This novel technique is essential for introducing antiprotons into the positron cloud at relatively low velocity so that antihydrogen can form with low energy and reduce the heating of the positron plasma. That's just cool.
Yeah, I think I can do that in my garage this weekend.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah, well,
I think the physicists want another $1 billion is what they want.
Yeah, well, it costs more,
and
than
they're more likely to get it.
Yeah, there you go.
No.
That's big science there,
policy
baby.
Policy makers are old white men, right? You know, pretty much, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, and they're old and dying, right? So
Well, it all goes to self-preservation, right?
Absolutely.
Mark, right? Is he sure it's not cold fusion?
No, hey, if you have a stream, if you could capture it and then release a stream of anti-carbon and then another stream of carbon, just think of the engine that you could produce. It's awesome. But you could also study, of course, the major laws of fundamental symmetries or gravitation, right? Understand your universe.
Which we're hoping will help build towards some kind of a cold fusion or maybe even a hot fusion reactor that we could use as a source of energy.
Yeah, well, hey, exactly. And then
they don't want to build more.
Engine.
They don't want
sorry,
to build.
Sorry, Andre.
More.
Andre made me promise.
They don't want to build more bombs. They want to build warping.
All right. You know, I'm going to go around the table. We've run out of time. I'd like to thank everybody that have joined us today. We have Vincent Ragnaiello, who's professor of microbiology and host of This Week in Virology, This Week in Parasitism. He's professor at Columbia University. And you can find him at twiv.tv. Thank you, Vincent, for coming on board.
Pleasure, Mark. Always a good time. And thanks for the conversation.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming. We also have Andre Nantel, who's a senior research officer at the Biotechnology Research Institute, the BRI Microarray Lab in Montreal, Canada, adjunct professor at McGill University. You can find him at about.me/Nantel. And by the way, you have to check out his site. He is the best photo blogger I've ever seen. He does incredible high dynamic range photos. He does incredible people. He takes photos of individuals, portraits that are fantastic, and funky little things that he sees in his travels.
Thanks, Mark.
Anything from the garage there?
I'll take a picture of my antimatter generator this weekend once I've got it built with whatever.
It's a series of tubes, man. It's a series of tubes. You need a solenoid. You need a T1 magnet. You've got your antimatter generator.
Well, while we're geeking out, maybe I should just throw in a shout out. On Monday, I'm going to be in this Montreal Geek podcast called Two Fat Dads, and they're having me as a guest because they seem to like the kind of stuff I'm in. So just follow me on Twitter at Nantel, and I'll throw the address once it's on.
Okay, so that's cool. about.me/Nantel and on Twitter at Nantel, N-A-N-T-E-L. Thanks, Andre, for coming on board.
You're welcome. Have a nice weekend, guys.
Also, we have Dr. George Farr, who is Vice President of Biochemistry and Biophysics at Aromics LLC, and he's also an adjunct professor in the Department of Physiology at Case Western Reserve. Thanks, George, for coming on.
Hey, thanks. I always learn something new with you guys, and you always make me think about things that I hadn't considered. I appreciate it very much.
I'd also like to thank our very special guest, Mark Gerstein, who's the Albert L. Williams Professor of Biomedical Informatics, and he's also Professor of Molecular Biophysics and Biochemistry, and of Computer Science at Yale University. Thank you. It was amazing. We picked a story, and then we were able to get you on to help, you know, really figure it out. Thank you, Mark.
Well, thanks. I had a great time on the thing, and I do regret I can't see anyone, but
it's okay.
But I'll do that next time.
Sure.
I don't think you regret it.
This is a compelling video, man.
That's fighting words, Vincent.
It's a very compelling video. Hey, so yeah, that's it's really cool, Mark. I really, really appreciate it. We'll have to have you on again.
Okay.
Oh, and by the way, thanks for the Yale Morph server.
Oh, sure. Yes.
I've used it a bunch in the past to animate a number of protein reactions with respect to GROEL function. And that server was awesome.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah. I have no pictures of myself, but I have lots of moving molecules there. you can look those to a video or something. Okay, thank you.
I'd like to thank Bert McQuinn for handling the audio video boards and the recordings today. I'd also like to thank the team that make this possible. Leo Laporte, Lisa Kenzel, Rick, Louis, Ken Shepherdson, Tony Wang, Mike Taylor, John Salina, Jeff Stewart, and Jason Howell. Lastly, but not least, I'd like to thank Phil Peltsy and Will Hall for the opening and closing themes. If you have any comments or suggestions, you can reach me at mark, M-A-R-C, at twit.tv or on Twitter at M-A-R-C, P-E-L-L-E-T-I-R, at Mark Pelletier. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Peltsy.